This is the Comics Alternative, episode 214, Recent Crime Comics, part 2. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Comics Alternative. I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy, and we're two guys with PhDs talking about comics.
And this week, Andy and I have our second of the two-part series. We began last week with Recent Crime Comics, but before we get into that discussion, we want to let all of you know that this episode of the Comics Alternative is brought to you by the great folks at Discount Comic Book Service. Go to their website, dcbservice.com, for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. There, you're going to find all DC, Marvel, Image, and Dark Horse titles at 40% off of the cover price if you pre-order. For all of the other publishers, you'll find that those discounts are 20 to 35% off of the cover price. And every month, you'll find some wonderful, unbelievable specials. Sometimes those specials will be at 45% off of the cover price. Sometimes 50% off cover, but many times you can find discounts that are more impressive than that.
That's right, and this month, as in every month, you can check out their bundles where you can get a deeper discount on multiple comics from the same publisher. And this month, they have loads of bundles from Marvel, DC, Valiant, and so on. So please check those out.
That's right. You can always find great prices every single month at Discount Comic Book Service. Their website is dcbservice.com. Go there for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. And after you do get your comics there, please be sure to send them an email and tell them that the two guys with PhDs sent you.
That's right.
Well, Andy, as we had with last week's Crime Comics episode, the first of the two-parter. We have a lot to discuss, but before we jump into those titles for this week, we should share with our listeners a couple of messages that we've received.
Okay.
Mail time.
Ooh, the mail's here. That means we get to see our old friend Mailbox.
And actually, the first message is from someone that we shouted out last week, and that is Sturge Batsakis. And he sent us a message on Facebook. He said, "Thanks for the shout-out, guys. I had been meaning to support your Patreon for a while, and I'm glad I finally got to do it." And we're glad about that as well, Sturge. Thanks.
Yeah, I wonder if we're going to be getting into a unending shout-out cycle now, where he will thank us for the shout out on this episode, and then we will shout out again, and it'll just keep going endlessly.
You know, I think that you may have inadvertently just put out a challenge or a dare, if you want to put it that way.
It'll be like what is it that Jimmy Kimmel does, where he says, you know, my apologies to Matt Damon at the end of every episode.
Well, I don't know.
Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. That like pretending that he has to bump Matt Damon in every single episode. Anyway.
So again, thanks, Sturge, for the message on Facebook. Glad you're listening and glad you're a Patreon supporter. And speaking of Patreon, the other message that we received is from another Patreon supporter, and this is Christopher Baird. He's been a longtime supporter of the show, and he sent us a message via Patreon. And he writes, "Hi, Derek and Andy. Just finished listening to the November preview show this morning while out running. I used the show to assist with my monthly order of books from Discount Comic Book Service." I hope at least that he said the two guys sent me.
Yeah.
"Also, I am really enjoying the Euro Comic Show. Coincidentally, I have been back ordering the Incal series from Humanoids through DCB Service this past year, so it's great to have other suggestions. Please, could you sign the bookmarks? I know that might only be Derek due to geographic considerations, but any signatures would be appreciated, as they will be worth more on eBay." Then he wraps up by saying, "Thanks again, guys. Signed, an honored patron." Now, what he's referring to in terms of the bookmark is that Christopher has been supporting us through Patreon for a while at the $5 level. And because of the recent changes in our Patreon campaign, now those at the $5 a month level not only are official podcast patrons, but also get a handful of the official Comics Alternative bookmark. And so he's asking us to sign them before we mail them.
Yeah, I think the signatures may not make them worth more on eBay, but they will make it easier to forge checks and make credit card applications in our names.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And we're all about helping out our listeners.
Yep.
Yeah. So again, thanks, Chris, for getting in touch with us and supporting us on Patreon. The bookmarks will soon be in the mail.
Yep.
Whenever the laws of any state are broken, a duly authorized organization swings into action. It may be called the state police, state troopers, militia, the rangers, or the highway patrol. These are the stories of the men whose training, skill, and courage have enforced and preserved our state laws.
Well, Andy, let's get into the books that we're going to be discussing this week. And there are several titles that we're going to be covering. Let's give a rundown of those quickly. We're going to begin in a few moments with Jim Thompson's The Killer Inside Me. After that, we're going to discuss briefly Demonic, then Wolf Cop, and then after that, Violent Love, Grand Passion, and then the first miniseries of Goldie Vance. And most of these titles, we're going to be just discussing the first or the number one issue of them, although in some cases there have been two or three issues that have come out of some of these titles. One of those being the first one we're going to be discussing, Jim Thompson's The Killer Inside Me. And, you know, this is originally written by, as the title suggests, Jim Thompson, but it's adapted by Devin Faraci, or is it Faraci?
I think it's Faraci.
Faraci, Devin Faraci, and Vic Malhotra. So this comes out from IDW, and the first issue of this was released in August. And I think so far we have, as of this recording, two issues, right?
That's what I've seen so far. I'm not sure if a third issue's come out yet.
Yeah, and this is going to be, is it a four-issue miniseries or five?
Again, that I don't know.
Okay, that I remember seeing that a few months ago when it was originally solicited. But here we have a miniseries based on Thompson's classic noir novel, The Killer Inside Me. And Andy, you've read The Killer Inside Me, right?
Yeah, I've read it a number of times, and I've taught it too in a crime and noir class I put together a few years ago. Well, actually, multiple times I've taught that class, more than once. Because it's in the book is in the Library of America collection of noir comics from the 40s and, or not noir, noir comics noir novels from the 40s and 50s
right
or
I think
crime
this,
novels
yeah this is in the 50s volume
yeah the yeah. 40s and 50s volume
40s and
yeah.
50s volume yeah
right or is it just yeah there's a 30s and 40s
right and then there's
volume
a 40,
and
there's
50,
50s and 60s 50. Yeah. So, yeah, this is in that second volume. And I don't only want to talk about this by contrasting it or comparing it to the original novel, although I guess, you know, since I've read the novel as well, I can't help but think in those terms.
Right.
And I would wonder what my experience with this comic would be had I not been familiar with The Killer Inside Me. I do want to begin, though, by saying that one thing that struck me is that my experience with The Killer Inside Me, the comic, was a little different in that I actually got to see a representation of what someone thought that the main character, Lou, would look like. And that tended to, and it had been a while since I'd read The Killer Inside Me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that looking at the illustration set me off on kind of a different interpretation of my original experience reading the novel.
That's interesting, because one of the other questions I wanted to ask you was, have you seen the film version that was made a few years ago with Casey Affleck as Lou?
I did not, no.
Okay. Because the comic made me think of that as well as the original novel. And I think one of the things you're getting at that is a big issue with this is that the novel is this, really amazing experiment in first person narration.
Right.
That works really well in a novel. Does it translate to a visual medium? And I think one of the questions that comes from that is what you're getting at there, which is, well, if in a first person narrative, we're essentially kind of seeing through Lou's eyes anyway, what happens when we're outside of that perspective and we see him? Did the Lou in the comic match your imagined version or resemble your imagined version?
Not really, especially in terms of outward expression, outward appearance. In other words, how he would seem by someone just walking down the street and passing him. Mm-hmm. The cowboy hat, I mean, yeah, you know, that's the whole Texas part of this story. But the way that Malhotra draws the character Lou Ford from the very beginning, and this is on the cover of issue number one, mm-hmm. you see a character who seems devious and underhanded in some way. And I think that this is played out, especially over the first part of that first issue, right? He's looking rather sinister. And I don't, at least my experience with the original, reading the original novel, is that this is not necessarily someone who looks sinister, who looks dangerous. Mm-hmm. In fact, that adds to the terror of Thompson's novel, that this is someone who appears just as normal as you or me or anyone, and he's nonetheless capable of doing the kind of things that he does in the book. Mm-hmm. But seeing him on the cover and then in the pages of the first issue of The Killer Inside Me, the comic, you could just tell that that he was evil, that this guy was capable of committing the kind of violence that he actually does.
That's an interesting point, because I would even push it a step further that it isn't just that Lou should look like you or I, but that Lou is disarming to everybody he meets. And he has that kind of, one of the things that always struck me as odd about the novel, and then I always had a hard time wrapping my head around, was how Lou uses these cliches in his conversations mm-hmm. that make people so uncomfortable. I'm always confused a little bit as to what it is about them that makes them uncomfortable. But one way I try to see it is that he's a guy that not only does he not come across as necessarily dangerous, but that he comes across as fairly simple.
Right. And, exactly.
And so I imagine a guy who's probably a little bigger, you know. The other thing about the way Lou's depicted in this comic is that he's really skinny. He's kind of tall and skinny. Mm-hmm. And I imagine him to be a kind of a bulkier guy who then, you know, kind of puts off this air of being this kind of yokel, small town cop that nobody, you know, nobody sees as dangerous and who is genuinely seems to be kind of genuinely good hearted, but relatively simple. But a few people kind of are able to see through that veneer.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. The thing about his cliches and the way that he speaks, he comes across as, you know, kind of innocuous just because, you know, the way you put it, he's, you know, appears to people to be simple. And also for me, I read him as a bit of a goofball and or corny, right? Someone who is non-threatening just because of that. And, you know, in the novel, and I think in the comic as well, we realize that he's using that veneer as a way of masking himself, and, you know, which just adds to the terror. But again, when it comes to the way that Malhotra draws him, and there's nothing wrong with the art itself. I'm not suggesting that at all. But again, we're given certain expressions from Lou that suggest to me, at least, that there's something we should watch out for. So in other words, I think that if I had never read the novel and I came to this comic book series, that from the very beginning, again, starting with the cover, that I would see something sinister from the very beginning.
I think that is really kind of helping me with my earlier point, where how do you render a narrative that's meant to be internal in a visual way? Well, one of the ways is that Faraci relies on narrative caption boxes. But another way that you have to kind of reflect Lou's interiority is through his, you know, through his eyes and through his looks. So, you know, I'm looking on, I don't have the page numbers marked. It's on page 21 of my PDF that I'm looking at. So it's probably about page 19 or so in the book, where Lou is meeting with the rich guy in the community, Chester Conway.
Right.
And he's looking over his, it's a simple image of Lou looking over his coffee cup at Chester, but the look is clearly one of hatred and just, you know, pure disdain. And so that is, and then their caption says, I couldn't take him much longer, even if I hadn't known what he had done to Mike, to Lou's, foster brother. So that look is there in order to reflect what in the novel we would have gotten from Lou's narration.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm wondering, though, if maybe showing these kind of visual cues to that, that kind of give away certain things, that what we've been discussing, may be a way of condensing the novel. And because this is, in fact, I just looked it up, this is going to be 5 issues. And the third issue comes out later this month. And so you and I have only read the first 2 issues, but just within the first 2 issues, they've only captured, I think, I went back to look right before we started to record, I think only up to chapter 8 of the novel. So, and that's really not that much time. So I'm wondering if, as an act of condensing the material, they're giving certain things away through the visuals, through the expression, through the ways that characters interact, in ways that maybe in the novel you have to read through further to get a sense of things. So, I mean, because, you know, you mentioned Conway and the relationship between Lou Ford and Conway. The whole question of how Conway feels about Lou and what he suspects, almost from the very beginning, is definitely a central part of the novel and how it works, right? Because it's not until closer to the end, without giving anything away, that the reader begins realizing, oh, well, Conway probably suspected a lot more than we assumed. And that's when things really begin to unravel for Lou Ford. But in the book, like you were mentioning, that interaction between the two, again, it kind of gives us a little more of a clue as to what to expect and who knows what.
And I think that also raises one of the other questions I had about the challenge of adapting something like The Killer Inside Me, which is that things that are subtle or up to the reader's interpretation have to be often end up getting rendered visually, so that it loses its ambiguity in some ways. And one of the you know, that. And so I'm going to be curious to see how the novel how the comic progresses in dealing with the fact that, you know, that Lou really doesn't know what's going on.
Right.
And so when we're reading the novel, we're fooled around along with him. But even other things like this is again on page 12 of the PDF, so probably 10 or so of the comic, where Lou is thinking back, or he's talking to the union boss about his adopted or foster brother, and in the novel, Lou does something to a little girl. And we're never quite sure what that is.
Right.
But his foster brother, Mike, takes the blame for it and ends up getting sent away. And so the comic, when it's showing that flashback, doesn't quite show what happened, but does show something.
Right. You get a pretty good sense of what probably might have happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's another thing that I think is maybe more effectively left open to the imagination. And that actually raises an anecdote I had about this, because when I've taught The Killer, have you ever taught The Killer Inside Me?
Never have.
Okay. When I've taught it, it is a pretty successful book in class. Students really, really, I don't want to say like it. they have a lot to talk about with it, and especially the way the ending comes up on them and what it does to make them have to rethink the whole novel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a couple students who took the class, and then they had graduated, but they kept kind of corresponding with me later on about how the novel really stayed with them. And it was around that time that the movie came out, and one of them wrote to me and she said, I couldn't watch the movie. I couldn't get 15 minutes into the movie and I had to leave. Because, and you know, that's pretty much where we start to see Lou's physical abuse of, I'm blanking on all the names of the prostitute.
Oh, of Joyce.
Of Joyce. Yeah.
Right.
And she just said, you know, I couldn't handle seeing that. Mm. I could handle it in the book, but when it's happening on screen, it was just too much. It was overwhelming to her. And I think that's really interesting as to how it then works as a comic, because a comic can still deal with ambiguity and subtleties in a way that maybe movies can't.
Right.
But not in the same way that prose can. But, you know, when we see Lou, you know, first fighting with Joyce and then, you know, later on in issue two, what happens with them is really, really pretty brutal.
Right.
In the comic.
You're right. They do represent that violence in the first two issues of The Killer Inside Me. But the difference between film and comics, obviously, is one of animation. And I think, you know, seeing the violence acted out in front of you on a screen is completely different from seeing a static image, as violent and bloody as it is. Mm-hmm. So I can understand your former student saying she couldn't sit through the rest of the movie. The violence is depicted here. I don't think that I didn't have a problem with that in the comic. You know, all of this, it's interesting because I said at the outset, I didn't necessarily want to focus on, you know, adaptation issues of how it's different from the book, but I guess, I mean, that's all we've been doing, and I guess that's kind of natural, though, because given our discussion, I'm wondering if what elements in the novel may not come out at all, perhaps, in this 5-issue series, and I'm wondering if, without giving anything away, if something that we learn in the novel, the relationship or whatever happened between the young Lou and the, I guess, housekeeper, maid, who worked for Lou's father, who was a distinguished town physician, right?
That's right.
If that will be excluded altogether, and the reason I'm wondering that, and maybe kind of suspect that that's the case, we don't get to see a more erudite side of Lou, at least in these first two issues of The Killer Inside Me, because in the novel, we do learn that, you know, as we mentioned, that kind of simpleton, all shucks, corniness is a facade, and there is someone much deeper behind that facade, someone who could have gone on to study medicine and been a successful scientist, doctor, like his father. And we see him often in the novel in his father's study, because his father's dead now, and Lou has inherited the house that had been both the home and also his office for the, you know, the doctor's office. So, you know, him taking down his father's books, reading, and not just in English, but in a variety of different languages. We don't get that much of that side of Lou here in the comic, so I'm guessing that the texture of his past life and of who he actually is, this deeper side of him, is going to be kind of washed out. And maybe out of necessity, given the fact that this is just five issues.
Well, that's interesting, because we do get the one page, about page 14 or so.
That first
issue? Where he's in his father's study, and he says, I read a German periodical and then a bit of a Spanish book. He does a calculus problem. So it's touched on there.
Yeah.
But it is never the, you know, the novel really, as you're talking about, makes it, and it just really reinforces the idea that there's two Lou Fords. There's the public and the private Lou Ford, and they're so divided. They're so much more divided than our normal public versus private personas are.
Right.
I think that's interesting, because there in the book there's that ambiguous relationship with the maid, but there's also his father's relationship with her.
Right.
And there's a point in the novel where he sees a picture.
Yes, he takes down his father's biblical concordance, I think it is.
Yeah, and can't quite figure out what he's seeing in the picture. I'm really curious, you know, again, if, you know, you bringing this up, is that relationship going to be explored or shown in the book? Is there is a moment where the visual, you know, narrative of the comic is going to fix something that we have to imagine,
right,
in the book.
You're right, because in the original novel, when he looks at that photograph, at first he's unsure what to make of that image. It's a curious angle. He thinks he's able to decipher it later, but it's still unclear exactly what he's seeing.
Yeah.
And so it's definitely unclear and ambiguous what we as readers are supposed to imagine. I suspect that won't be a part of the comic. And again, I think just because of brevity's sake, if you introduce that photo, then that's going to open more narrative material than I think this five-issue series is going to have time for and space for. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the adapters, Faraki and Malhotra, are going to be able to pull that off. But I don't know.
Yeah, I'll wait to see before I kind of, you know, judge whether they're going to do it or not. But if they don't, then there's a whole explanation of Lou's treatment of women that will get lost.
Right.
You know, because he learned something. I mean, the way he abuses women comes largely from his father, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'll be curious then how if that gets glossed over.
Yeah. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
So the third issue of this series comes out later this month, and I guess this will be wrapped up by early next year.
Yep.
Yeah, I want to see this all the way through.
Yeah. And I think also even though we did spend all our time talking about adaptation issues, I think that there's interesting challenges that this particular work poses, and I'm curious to see how the creators overcome the challenge. But I think also, I think when you get down to it, I mean, you asked about someone reading this without having read the original. I think you're still going to get a pretty pure noir story,
right,
with a lot of disturbing stuff happening in it. One that pushes some of the boundaries of noir even further than it already. Than they're already normally pushed in a regular narrative. So I think that that even if, you know, someone listening to this who's like, I don't understand this, I haven't read the book, we'll still get something out of this as a crime story.
Right. Yeah. We don't want to suggest by any means that you have to be familiar with either the novel or the film in order to appreciate the comic. I mean, I think the comic on its own, from what we've seen so far, definitely stands.
Yep.
Well, let's move on to another title that began at about the same time, back in August, and we have three issues of that out right now. And this is Demonic by Christopher Sabella and art by Nico Walter. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a different kind of crime story. It's one that, I don't know, it. At times I think that it's more crime than horror, at other times more horror than crime, but it's a mix of the two, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like having, I don't know what, peanut butter and chocolate and together making it something wholly other. But basically what we have here is the story of a detective by the name of Scott Graves, and he goes with his partner, at least in this first issue, named Fisher, to a domestic dispute that turns extremely nasty, violent. It results in a death. And when they check in on a woman who apparently has killed her, I guess, husband, there's certain questions that are raised about Detective Graves' past. And this woman who's turned violent starts mentioning De Novo and Ashma, and I'm not sure how you pronounce that, A-E-S-H-M-A.
Right.
And we see in this first issue especially the fact that Scott Graves, Detective Graves, has some experience with these things, but we don't know what these things are. Mm-hmm. Now, later in this first issue, this demon, I guess we can call it, Ashma, comes to Graves and says to him that, you know, she has a deal for him. She's going to save his daughter. And of course, we also learn in this issue that, you know, his wife's daughter is really ill and close to death, so that the demon will, you know, save his daughter Lucy if he does things for her. In other words, he makes a deal with the devil, so to speak. And then this deal includes killing, especially killing individuals that deserve it. And so this is what we have over the first three issues of Demonic. And I couldn't help but think of Brubaker's Kill or Be Killed as I was reading this.
I get that connection. It's interesting, though, that you know, I think Kill or Be Killed is playing more with the ambiguity.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are things that, at least in Demonic, that are spelled out a little more. Although, a big difference between Demonic and Kill or Be Killed is that there is a narrative context that Sabella has in mind that at times makes it a little difficult to understand what's going on, because he reveals information piece by piece. So, for instance, it's not until – I can't remember if it's issue three or if it's in two – that we learn a little more about Graves' past and mm-hmm. when he was a kid and what his parents did with him, the link to Novo and what that's all about. But then we also find that there are people on the force, the police force, that also have a connection to Novo. And so then it becomes a game as to, you know, who will discover whom first. So there's a lot that's not explained in Demonic that I'm sure will as the series develops. But at times I was a tad, not completely, but a tad frustrated in not knowing what was going on in certain places, especially in the first couple of issues.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to mention, too, about Demonic is the art by Nico Walter, which I really like. It has that style that I think is common now to a lot of noir comics that we're getting. It's something like, you know, it's got some qualities of Michael Lark's.
I was thinking the same thing. Yeah.
And so a clean line, but also uses heavy shadows. And again, I think like Sean Phillips, for example, would be a little more on the shadowy side. But something pretty close, not quite photorealistic either, but definitely not in the kind of exaggerated heroic art that you see in superhero comics.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the way that the individuals look. I mean, there is something that, you know, definitely on the more realistic side, but there's something about the angularity that suggests more of kind of a chunkiness, and not chunkiness in terms of these people are overweight, but the way that the angles of their face and even their bodies are represented. So, and I think that adds to the noir feel to this, to the mystery. And it's something that, you know, I'm probably going to return to just to see how the story plays out. Although it didn't hit me on a gut level like Kill or Be Killed. And I guess the reason for that is, you know, one, with Kill or Be Killed, is Ed Brubaker, you know, who's a master at crime writing. But also, as you pointed out, Brubaker's narratives usually are a little more compelling just because of that interwoven ambiguity.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and I don't know if I mentioned it, but this is an Image comic.
Yeah.
Well, another book we're going to be looking at, and I think talking very briefly about, because I don't know how much we want to or have to say about this, is from Dynamite Entertainment, and this is Wolf Cop. It's written by Max Marks with art by Arcana Studios. And so it's not just one individual here. It's a studio who has provided the art of this book. And Andy, have you seen the film? I think it came out in 2014, Wolf Cop.
No, but I think it's in Netflix.
Okay, so I may want to – I don't know if I want to watch this, but I may want to take a gander at the visuals just to see what's going on here. I haven't seen the film either. This is a Canadian film, and my guess is from reading this first issue that just recently came out from Dynamite that this is one of those over-the-top, crime, violent type of films that – kind of just lets everything loose in such a way that it becomes ridiculous, but the ridiculousness becomes a part of its appeal.
Okay.
And again, I haven't seen the film. I just get that sense from watching the comic, because the comic deals with what I assume to be and what I've read about the film. Very similar setup. We have the main character, Lou Garou, and he is an alcoholic police officer who also is a werewolf. And so, you know, as the classic werewolf becomes what he is or she is, you know, when the moon's out, you know, so Lou is also – there are a lot of Lous in this episode, by the way.
Lou is a good noir name.
That's right. We got Lou in The Killer Inside Me. We got Lou in Wolf Cop. And we'll have a Lou in Violent Love. You know, Lou in Wolf Cop, he, you know, turns into a werewolf, and then becomes an uncontrollable killer. He's got a friend named Willie in the movie. And here we have Willie in the opening pages is driving with him. And he's getting on Lou's case about drinking and driving. And then they get into this first situation. Now, I don't know if this is going to be an ongoing series or what, or if it's going to be limited to a certain number of issues. Mm-hmm. But if this first issue of Wolf Comp is any indication, this may be a series where each issue is kind of an episode or adventure that stands on its own, because what we have in issue one of Wolf Comp could easily have been Wolf Comp the one shot, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a wrap-up, I guess, that we have in this first issue. And the wrap-up mm-hmm. deals with I don't know if he's ever named, but he's a werepig, I guess. He's a human who also turns into a boar, I guess, more of a boar than a pig. And he owns a place called the Meat Locker. And it's called the Meat Locker because this were-boar actually does eat meat people. And so he has his henchmen bring people, you know, young nubile women to him, and then he eats them. Mm. And so it's really sick. And this gets back to what I mentioned earlier, this kind of over-the-topness of Wolf Cop. Now, in reading this first issue, and I have to say, we usually don't read or discuss things on the podcast that we wouldn't recommend, that we don't like. Mm-hmm. I have to admit, I'm not going to read beyond this first issue of Wolf Cop. It's not my cup of tea. I think for those who like this kind of over-the-top weirdness and especially violence, then this is something that they may want to check out, especially if they enjoyed the movie from a couple of years ago. But it's just something that, you know, I'm not going to go on with. And it reminded me in its over-the-topness of something akin to a Sharknado.
Okay.
If it's just so weird and it's so mm-hmm. ridiculous that becomes its sole appeal.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, you said you're not making it, you're not going past the first issue. You made it further than I did. So,
and as I said at the beginning, we don't have much to say about Wolf Cop, but because we are looking for this week and then last week at recent crime comics, this mm-hmm. definitely does fall into that category.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, let's look next at a more appealing title, and this is issue number one of Violent Love, written by Frank Barbieri with art by Victor Santos. And this is one you and I have been wanting to look at for quite a while.
Yeah. When I first saw this get solicited in previews, I was really interested in it and what Barbieri and Santos are going to be doing.
Image title, by the way.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. And because I like, you know, well, I like both of these creators a lot, but, you know, Victor Santos has a style that I think really fits the historical setting that this comic takes place in, which is, what, 1969 or so.
Right.
Though we have a framing sequence that's set in 1987. So was it a grandfather and his granddaughter?
It seems to be that. Yeah, we don't know exactly. I want to talk about that framing sequence in a little bit. But you're right. The time setting, I think, is something that Santos does a really good job at representing.
Yeah.
And, you know, Santos's art, and I've thought of this for a long time, but it reminds me somewhat of the art of Darwin Cook. And Darwin Cook is the kind of artist who deals with these timepieces like the 1950s and 60s very well.
Yeah, so I think just as the art in Demonic, I think, represents a certain trend in a certain kind of crime, of contemporary crime comics that we get.
Right.
Today, I think Santos's art fits in with that more nostalgic noir style that we see in Darwin Cook. I think that's a really apt comparison.
Mm-hmm. Now, Violent Love is going to be the story of these, I guess, two lovers that go on a crime spree, and we don't know how violent they ultimately become, but it seems to be pretty damn violent. And the two people are Daisy Jane and Rock Bradley. Now, we see a photo or a poster image of a wanted image of Rock Bradley, but we don't see Rock in this first issue. But this first issue is devoted primarily to Daisy Jane and giving us a little backstory of her. And at the very beginning of this first issue, on the publication page, we see that it's called The Ballad of Daisy Jane, issue number one. Now, I don't know if this first issue is called The Ballad of Daisy Jane or this is what the first trade is going to be called.
Yeah.
I'm assuming the latter.
Yeah.
And so if that's the case, we may not see Rock Bradley for a while. We get a little context here as to what might have caused Daisy Jane to become the criminal that she ultimately becomes. But that's not how this first issue begins. And this gets back to what you were saying earlier when we get the frame sequence that takes place in Texas in 1987.
Right.
And this is basically, and I guess this is the grandfather of a little girl. The little girl's name is Penny. The older guy, I guess her grandfather, is called Lou. And Penny's mother drops her off at Lou's place. And Penny sees an old wanted poster with both Daisy Jane and Rock, and is wanting to know what that's all about. And so Lou says, well, if you want to hear this story, sit down. And so then what we read from then on is what Lou is telling Penny.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the context. Now, one question I have for you, I don't know if it's so much of a question or an observation / speculation, is in this opening sequence that takes place in 1987, we see Penny from the very beginning. We see Lou. We never see Penny's mother, who is driving the station wagon, taking Penny to see Lou. And we even see Lou talking with the driver as she's dropping off Penny. But again, we never see Penny's mother. So there are questions. First and foremost, who is Penny's mother? And even more importantly, what role is she going to be playing later on? In other words, what is going to be the big reveal? Because there has to be a big reveal here. The fact that we don't see who's driving this car.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Do we ever get a mention of how old Penny is?
I don't think so, but she looks to be around maybe 10.
Oh, see, I pegged her as a little older than that, maybe as a teenager.
So maybe 13.
Who knows,
maybe.
But if we're talking, that framing sequence taking place in 1987 and then the story proper taking place in 1969. So we've got, it got 18 years later. So, I see where you're going with this. I hadn't actually thought about that.
Yeah. And one would think, oh, well, maybe Daisy's going to be Penny's mother. However, in the setup, when Lou begins to tell his story and he's saying that, if you're sure you want to hear this, because not, every story has a happy ending. Sometimes they have really tragic endings. And Lou says at one point, and this is, and we're looking at a PDF review copy, and I think I'm on page 10 of that. He says, but all fires got to burn out eventually, and these two went out how they came in, hard, fast, and loud. Mm-hmm. Now, if you just take what he says, there's nothing in the words to suggest that Daisy Jane is dead now. But the visuals that accompany those words do suggest that probably at least if the images that we're seeing are of Rock and Daisy, then they're dead, that they went out like Bonnie and Clyde in a blaze of glory. But we don't know for a fact that this is Daisy and Rock. So there's a big question mark as to who the mother of Penny is and what role does she have in this larger narrative.
That's right. When we get into The narrative itself. One of the things you mentioned is that we don't see Rock at all in this in the 1969 section. And in that sense, it made me wonder if this might follow a structure, something more like Sex Criminals, where, you know, we didn't see, I can't remember the characters' names anymore in that series, the main male character in the first issue.
Oh, right.
The main female character was a focus. We got her story and then we got his story.
Yeah.
Second. So, you know, maybe what we see here is, and a lot happens in this first issue, is we see Daisy at the beginning being pretty independent and headstrong and willing to stand up for herself.
Mm-hmm.
But we definitely don't see her on a path towards becoming a vicious criminal.
Right.
So that's still to come. But we do see the events that set her on that path eventually.
Yeah. We also learn in the second half of this first issue that Daisy's father, who at first seems like a typical loving everyday kind of dad, actually does have a darker past, and mm-hmm. it's what happens as a result of this darker past and that darker past coming back to him in certain ways that sets her on the path that she's going to take after this first issue. So I think that this issue number one of Violent Love does a great job of beginning to set up her character. And then, if we don't get Rock until 5 or 6 issues into this series, I'm perfectly okay with this because it's really good to see what Barbieri is doing with the character here, and I hope he really plays up the storytelling aspect of this, that we come back often as we do in this first issue to Lou telling Penny the story of Daisy Jane and Rock Bradley.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked a lot about comics written by Frank Barbieri on the podcast over the past several years. Almost everything he's done, we've discussed in one way or another.
Yeah, you know, he's one of those writers that consistently does really good work. I mean, we haven't talked about his mainstream stuff.
Right.
But it definitely is independent stuff. And he's, you know, he's one of those writers who I think continuously does really quality work. He's diverse. He can work in a variety of genres really well. And I don't think he gets enough credit.
And I think he doesn't get enough credit for all the reasons that you said. He works in a variety of different genres and contexts really well. In other words, he's someone, you give him a job and he'll do it. And I think because of that, he hasn't defined himself through a particular kind of writing, a particular kind of comic or genre. So,
yeah, but you know, I really hope that Violent Love ends up being this kind of breakthrough work. I mean, I think that he's had a lot of success already, but the book that kind of stands out, and I think Santos's art should be a big part of that as well, because, you know, this looks great. I think Santos is an artist who doesn't get enough credit either. Mm-hmm. So but the two of them working together, I mean, there's a collaboration here that's really strong. I'm really looking forward to seeing where this goes. I'm a big fan of this type of narrative anyway, the young teenage couple who are in love and go on a crime spree. The whole Bonnie and Clyde, I guess,
mm-hmm.
narrative. But, one of the things that this book really did remind me of, and I hope continues to remind me of, is Terrence Malick's movie Badlands with Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek, which is one of my all time favorite movies, which is kind of loosely based on the Charles Starkweather story, the famous, also the real life basis for the young couple on a crime spree.
Hey,
Well, you know, on the topic of this premise, right, a young couple on a crime spree, we can pair this first issue of Violent Love with the next title that we're going to be discussing, and this is Grand Passion number one, written by James Robinson with art by Tom Feister, and this is also a Dynamite comic. Although this seems to be kind of a different setup, because this title, this first issue begins with a couple that's in love that's on a crime spree, Mabel and Steve. But what this series will become is not a story about Mabel and Steve because of what happens to Steve at the end of this first issue. It's also the story of Deputy Mac McNamara, and he will become the subject of what happens in Grand Passion, because here we have kind of a twist on the crime spree thing, where Mabel and McNamara are coming from completely different perspectives, right? So Mabel mm-hmm. is the criminal, Mac is the police officer. The moment they see each other, they know they're in love.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole idea of love at first sight here is taken to an extreme that these two don't even know anything about each other except that one's a cop and one's a criminal, and yet they look at each other and that connection is immediate. And so I think what you're pointing to there as well is something that does distinguish this book from Violent Love, which is that it is it is over the top, you know, in a lot of ways that Violent Love isn't, in terms of, you know, kind of what it's grounding in reality.
Right. Not over the top the way that Wolf Cop is over the top.
No, definitely not. But that that you have these extreme characters. And it's very funny. I mean, Steve and Mabel, when they commit these various crimes, I mean, there's a page early on where we see a kind of montage of different crimes they've committed that are and they wear costumes to each one of these crimes.
Different ones with each
right,
crime.
Exactly. And so the current one that we're in is that, you know, he's a priest and she's a pregnant woman, but they have a lot of odd pairings going along throughout. Throughout their criminal career. And in that sense, it reminded me a little bit of The Fix, in the kind of humor that's involved in their criminal activities.
Now, it's interesting that you say that, because I definitely got the humor in the very first part of this first issue. Mm. After that, though, I don't know if anything else about this number one issue was humorous, because even that almost over the top scene, you know, where they fall in love, where they see each other, that doesn't strike me as overly humorous. Although the fact that they do this, you know, in this sea of smoke, because Mabel has thrown a couple of smoke bombs out so she can get away. I mean, there's something kind of funny about that, but I don't know if Robinson plays it. Robinson and Feister are playing it for humor here. I see where you're going in comparing it to the Fix, which we discussed and had a great time discussing last week. I just don't know if this is going to have that same kind of feel to it. I don't know, but it's an intriguing story, and it has me wondering what's going to happen, because there's certain things. I don't want to give any spoilers, but when we see Mabel in the very last panel, she is making some kind of declaration, and even though we know that she's in love with Mac, and then vice versa, that this is something that is destined not to be.
Yeah, we'll have to see where that plays out, but I'm kind of hoping that tonally this series takes the more kind of over the top approach to the narrative, because it is such a crazy premise to begin with.
Yeah.
And you're right about how that that humorous tone doesn't sustain itself, because when we get into Mac's story, he's not in a great situation. He's a cop in this small town, but pretty much all the other cops in this town are related to the sheriff in some way. And so he's really an outsider amongst his fellow coworkers, to the point that he's basically told, you got to just keep to yourself and not associate with these people.
Right. And so, yeah, what you've mentioned, what we haven't really brought up yet, and that is Mac's context. You know, he's someone who is a part of, you know, a Southern Illinois police force that he doesn't feel a part of. He's definitely an outsider. He's just recently lost his wife. We don't know a lot of detail about what went on there. Mm-hmm. And so this is someone who is definitely trying to get his life back together. You know, not that meeting Mabel and falling in love with her is going to help him to do that, but I think he's kind of prime pickings for the disaster that is probably going to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
One of the other things I did want to mention with this book is the art, which is I think that the artist Tom Feister is doing some really interesting things in this comic.
Mm-hmm.
With narrative, with layouts, pages with lots of panels in them. Though in many of the panels, the same image is repeated over and over again. I'm curious to keep reading this for that reason too. I think again, like Violent Love, there's an interesting collaboration going on here between these creators.
Exactly. You know, that one of the references that you made, the page or pages where we have a lot of smaller repetitious panels, that's the one at the very beginning when we're first introduced to Mac, and he's with his partner Chad, and they're waiting for a train to go by at a crossing.
Yeah.
And this is, yeah, I really do love this two-page spread, and this is one of the drawbacks of reviewing comics through a PDF.
Yeah,
in that you don't get the full effect of what we have here with a two-page spread. I mean, sometimes you can get, you know, for the most part, what the artist is trying to reveal here. But because of the number of panels arranged as they are, when I first read this, it took me a beat or two to realize that these two pages are part of it, should be read as a two-page spread and not otherwise. And I had to go back and reread them and then appreciate what Feister was doing there.
Yeah.
But, I enjoy his art as well. I was going to mention that if memory serves, we discussed this solicit, Grand Passion number one, the same episode that Violent Love number one was solicited, that preview show, correct?
Right, because we had made a comparison between the two.
Yeah.
And they are definitely different.
They're different, but, there's enough connection there for us to, I guess, reasonably follow Grand Passion from a conversation on Violent Love.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
There need to be more couples going on crime sprees like this.
Yeah, bring this one. Bring more love into crime.
Yeah. One of my other favorites of this genre, or I guess subgenre, is the movie Gun Crazy, which is a movie I watch over and over again. And sort of probably is a little bit in this book, in that the two main characters in that movie on their crime spree are circus performers. So they show up in their kind of cowboy and cowgirl costumes when they go to, because they're like trick shooters in a traveling show. And so they show up in their cowboy and cowgirl costumes when they rob a bank.
Hmm. Well, I'm surprised that Natural Born Killers hasn't been brought up.
I hate that movie so much.
Oh, really? You hate it?
Yeah. I genuinely despise that movie.
Why? Why do you hate it?
It's just too much.
Okay. Well, it is too much. I agree. Well, let's move on to the last title that we're going to be discussing this week, and it is tonally very, very different from what we've been discussing, Violent Love, yeah. Grand Passion, and all the others, not only for this week, but also the crime comics in last week's episode. And right. This is Goldie Vance, written by Hope Larson with art by Brittany Williams. This comes out, or this came out through Boombox. And we're primarily going to be looking at what, in essence, is the first trade of Goldie Vance, because yeah. this was solicited as a four-issue miniseries, and those issues came out between April and July of this year. The trade came out just in October, but now Goldie Vance is an ongoing. So there's more than what we're going to be discussing with the first four issues, but the first four issues make up the first trade.
So is the... the series continuing with issue 5 or with a new issue 1, do you know?
I think with issue 5, yeah, because that came out in September. Right now they're up to issue number 7 for this month.
Okay.
And because it's published by Boombox, you can probably assume that this is much more of an all-age kind of comic. But it definitely fits within the theme of this and last week's show, because it is a crime comic. Basically, you have a teenager by the name of Goldie Vance, who is really good at thinking through things and solving problems and solving mysteries, solving crimes. And in this first narrative arc, or the first four issues of Goldie Vance, basically get the premise of I guess what the entire series will be. Her father is the manager of a hotel. And is it in Florida, I guess, that they are?
Yes. Okay. St. Pascal, Florida.
Okay, yes. So it's in Florida. And so she is, I guess, a valet. She works as a valet at the hotel that her father manages. But she also works closely with the hotel detective, a guy named Tui. And so she goes into his office every now and again to ask about what mysteries he's solving now and if there's anything that she can do to help. And so in this first volume of Goldie Vance, the mystery becomes one of, I guess, a Cold War nature. Now, we don't know exactly when this takes place, like in terms of year, but it seems to be the 1950s.
Yeah.
From the look of it, from the attire, the... you know, the decor, it just screams 1950s. But also you have kind of a classic, Cold War intrigue, right, where we do have Russian agents and you have a German scientist who basically, I mean, he's the gist of the mystery and the crime in these first four issues. And he's being pursued by Russian agents, but we don't know that at first.
Right. And that it's interesting that you mentioned the time and setting of this, because that's not apparent from the beginning. I don't think I didn't get a narrative caption box or something that says, 1955 or something like that.
Right.
So early on in the book, when Goldie is having a conversation with her friend Cheryl, and Cheryl is talking about her, her love for Alan Shepard, I was like, well, that's a pretty very kind of specific fan thing to be having in, in 2017 or 2016. But then once you realize when this is actually taking place, it's a mud that makes more sense that someone would be fascinated with Alan Shepard.
Exactly. Yeah. You can tell by the kind of clothes that they wear that this is taking place in the 1950s or maybe very early 1960s. Also, at one point, we get a character named Skunk Hess, who loves to race cars. And of course, he has, ducktail do. He just looks like someone from Happy Days.
Yeah. Right. And the fact that, that drag racing these classic cars, which I guess would have been contemporary cars then, is also a giveaway. But yeah, so one of the things I really loved about this series, or this first arc, is that it reminded me so much of my favorite books when I was a kid, like the Hardy Boys,
mm-hmm.
and Nancy Drew.
Yeah,
sure. Where the teen protagonist has, you know, has a parent who has an occupation that the teen ends up kind of tagging along with, and their mysteries then kind of stem out of that, their father's job. And at first, the kinds of things that Goldie seems to handle here, as, you know, in her assisting of the hotel detective, are pretty simple things, like, you know, finding a lost kid.
Right.
Or if something gets stolen out of the hotel room. This story, though, gets incredibly complicated,
mm-hmm.
as it goes along. That we have complicated in the sense we have way, way larger forces at work in the narrative. But in a mystery that starts out is fairly simple, that, you know, someone's a guest at the hotel loses a necklace.
Right.
Which probably not an uncommon thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then it becomes a much, much more uncommon experience as it goes along.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew feel mm-hmm. to this. So, yeah, you do have a smart teen who is able to solve mysteries in ways that maybe adults can. But, you know, another really big takeaway from Goldie Vance is that this is very much a female-centric narrative.
Yes.
And that's where I think much, if not most, of its power lies. And not only given the fact that you have a young female protagonist who's able to do what she does, you know, because Goldie is someone who doesn't just happen upon solutions. I mean, you know, she's a serious thinker. She's smart. She can, mm-hmm. she can figure out things when she puts her mind to it. But also the other characters in the series. Now, you mentioned her friend Cheryl, right? Now, mm-hmm. you would think that, you know, there would be, you know, a young man at this time who would be fascinated by space exploration and astronauts. But no, it's a young woman who is the physics astronomy aficionado. Mm-hmm. Even the female antagonists, right? And we have two here. There is the female Russian agent who is given mm-hmm. a prominent position. But there's also, I guess we can call her the, you know, Goldie's antithesis. And this is a young friend of hers named Sugar. Who mm-hmm. Sugar's father actually owns the hotel that Goldie's father manages. And Sugar is someone who used to be a childhood friend, but through, I guess, childhood competition, there was some bad blood. And so now mm-hmm. Sugar, you know, holds Goldie anathema, right?
Right.
And I guess vice versa. So, you know, even the female, the antagonists in this comic are women, right? And the men in this story, I mean, they play important roles, but they're more support. I mean, we don't really see that much of Goldie's father, even though he has an important part to play in these first four issues. Same thing with Mr. Tui, the hotel detective.
Right.
And right. then there's the character of Diane. We haven't said anything mm-hmm. about her yet.
Right. But to kind of go through some of the things you were saying there, I think that's one of the more interesting things about this book, is that it's set in this 1950s milieu, but it is kind of a fantasy version of that right. world, because we, you know, not only is it one where a character like Cheryl is not weird that she's into science and wants to be an astronaut, but it's actively encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also haven't mentioned that most of the characters in this comic are also people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's efforts to kind of reinforce positive images, I think, here is laudable. And, you know, and maybe even, you know, to create an alternate 1950s. That's different from the one that, you know, America actually went through, could have some value as well. So we've got the race and the gender aspects, but you're also, when you mentioned Diane, getting into the issues of sexuality that the book raises as well.
Right. Yeah. 'Cause I don't think a lot is made of Diane in terms of it, at least her, where her, you know, does she like boys? Does she like girls? But there's something about her that Goldie is drawn to, and she almost pines for Diane. But it's these first four issues are written in such a way that you don't know if Goldie pines for Diane for what she represents or because there's something else there. And I love that ambiguity, the way that Hope Larson wrote that into this story. I want to go back to something that you mentioned about race. And you're right that we're dealing primarily with characters who are people of color, right, and not mm-hmm. white. There are not many white people. Interestingly enough, though, I guess the most prominent white character outside of the Hotel Detective Tui is Goldie's mother.
Right.
And I think that's another interesting thing about this, because if and we don't know for, you know, is Mr. Vance, is he Hispanic? Is he African-American? We don't know for certain. Doesn't really matter. But he is drawn more dark and the mother is drawn white, and mm-hmm. Goldie comes off as a little dark, but not as. Okay, so you mm-hmm. definitely have a mixed marriage here. Now, even though Vance and his wife have divorced, then, you know, I don't think that that really matters. It adds to the story, if nothing else. But again, you're dealing with a kind of an alternate 1950s, is the way that you put it. But, you know, if you're looking for verisimilitude in mm-hmm. picking up Goldie Vance, then, you know, you're picking it up for the wrong reason. I mean, this is a comic that if Zoe, my daughter, were reading American comics, and it's not that if she doesn't, but she's more of a manga person. But this is something that I would definitely put in her hand,
right?
Because of the messages that it sends, and But I don't think it whitewashes, though, mm-hmm. the history.
Right. Well, no, but it's interesting to me in that it doesn't talk about it at all. Right.
Right.
And that, you know, that's clearly an intention on the part of the creators, and probably, you know, I think a worthy pursuit here too.
Right.
Give kids this, you know, because, you know, if you read Nancy Drew or Trixie Belden or Hardy Boys books, there's, you know, they were written at the time that this book set. And this gives an alternate view of the 50s, but an alternate view of the world in which those other stories take place, which themselves were not realistic reflections of what American society was like in the 1950s.
Right. And I'm, you know, thinking as we're discussing this, there's almost something cartoon-like about Goldie Vance. And I'm saying this not just because of Williams's art, which I really love, mm-hmm. but also in the way that, you know, we were talking about whereas they don't whitewash the history, they really don't engage with it much. And we see this not only in terms mm-hmm. of race relations and gender, but also in terms of the Cold War politics, right? Because Miss Petty, or at least she goes by Miss Petty, who's mm-hmm. the female Russian agent, and there's a male agent as well that we don't see much of. I mean, they strike me as very Boris and Natasha-like, you know? So what we see mm-hmm. here in Goldie Vance could be something almost like Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah,
the way that, you know, the Russian threat is represented here.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I'm glad you mentioned Brittany Williams' art. I really like her work on the Patsy Walker Hellcat comic from Marvel. And so I was happy to see her working also on a creator-owned book like this. And I think this book has the potential to be in there with, you know, the same audience that
Lumberjanes,
Lumberjanes, but also even bigger than that, like Raina Telgemeier's work. Mm. That is that kind of young adult reader appealing to that that demographic. And also, I'm happy for Brittany Williams' success too, because she's a South Carolina native, went to South Carolina State, I believe, and so. She's local.
Oh, cool. Well, have you met her?
No, I haven't.
Well, maybe after this episode goes up, she'll listen to it and then want to seek you out.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I liked Goldie Vance. I remember hearing about it earlier this year, but I didn't really check it out until we made a decision to do, you know, this crime comic series. And then knowing about, I guess, the basic premise of Goldie Vance, I thought, okay, it's definitely mm-hmm. worth checking out, and I'm glad I did.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, Andy, we're wrapping up the second of our two-episode series on recent crime comics. This week we looked at Jim Thompson's The Killer Inside Me, adapted by Devin Faraki and Vic Malhotra. After that, we looked at Demonic, from Christopher Sabella and Nico Walter. After that, Wolf Cop, by Max Marks and Arcana Studios. And I think if you want to at least begin to enjoy and appreciate Wolf Cop, you should see the film. Mm-hmm. After that, we looked at a couple of comics that we kind of paired. Frank Barbieri and Victor Santos's Violent Love, number one, and then James Robinson and Tom Feister's Grand Passion, number one. Then we wrapped up with the first trade by Hope Larson and Brittany Williams, Goldie Vance.
So that wraps up our two-part crime comics episode, and yet there are so many more crime comics out there and more to come.
You know, if you and I made a decision to use one of our regular weekly shows every month to look at that moment, recent crime comics, I think we could do so easily.
It's interesting that you said that instead of suggesting that we create a monthly crime comics show, because that's where I was worried you were heading with that. That yes, because we need to multiply the regular monthly shows we do. I don't know. Yeah, you know, it's a genre I love, and I'll keep up with it. It's not one that I've yet to be burned out on, like I have been about, you know, zombies and other post-apocalyptic stories that mm-hmm. have proliferated as well. So, you know, as long as my enthusiasm is still there, I'm going to keep reading these series as they come out.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to be talking about more crime comics in the months to come. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to find great prices on some of the titles that we've been discussing over the past couple of weeks, then you would do well to visit the website of our sponsor, Discount Comic Book Service. Go to dcbservice.com, and there you're going to find great deals on comics, crime-related and otherwise. And after you do get your comics there, get in touch with us and let us know what you think about our two-part recent crime comic series. If you go to the website, comicsalternative.com, you'll find that you can leave us a voice message via SpeakPipe. Or you can call us the old-fashioned way by picking up the phone and dialing 415-3-COMICS. That's 415-326-6427.
That's right, or you can get a hold of us by email. We are twoguys@comicsalternative.com, or you can get a hold of us individually. I'm Andy@comicsalternative.com.
And I'm Derek@comicsalternative.com.
And we also have our Twitter feed, which you can check out @2guys with PhDs.
That's right. But you can also find us on Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Google+, Goodreads, Pinterest, and YouTube. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. You can stream us on Stitcher. You can find us on TuneIn, on iHeartRadio, and on Spotify. And if you're an Android user, via Google Play Music. But you can find every single one of our podcast episodes, as well as the reviews and comics-related commentary that we post on our blog, by going to our website, which is comicsalternative.com.
That's right. All the ways to get a hold of us and let us know how we're doing and see what we're doing.
That's right. And we will be back next week with our annual Thanksgiving episode, and you will be hearing me, Andy, and several other Comics Alternative co-hosts talking about what we're thankful for in terms of comics.
That's right. And so until then, I'm Andy.
And I'm Derek. See you later.
See ya.